news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From my bunker in the lands below, a little further south than the sweet sunny south, that is. Welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, and once again going in pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every week via our station affiliates on the UNX Radio Network, KGRA, and of course via podcasting apps in pockets all across the globe. Glad to be here with you guys. This week we've got plenty on the table. Because there was a recent science paper, it was an opinion piece, published, but by a notable scientist who has put forth a rather remarkable idea. In fact, he isn't the only one. Could there be other varieties of hominins that might still exist? The kinds of things that we thought was left, of course, only to ancient history. We'll see what he had to say about that in a moment. Later in the program, we are going to be joined this week by Mr. Walter Bosley. Really been looking forward to having this conversation for quite a while. Walter's going to tell us all about his latest research, what his father might have had to do with one of the most infamous and perhaps the most controversial UFO case of all time. And then, of course, also how the UFO enigma as we know it today could have its roots in the 19th century. Now, that may sound like a very strange proposition. But of course, those of you who have been longtime listeners of this program know that we have looked at the fact that back in the 1800s, and particularly around 1896 and 1897, there were several reports in American newspapers detailing sightings of alleged airships in the skies, initially over California, but then making their way to the east, and they were seen over numerous states in the early months of 1897. Now, of course, most scholars who have looked at this, most conventional historians would say, well, you know, that's a quaint little echo of the past. People, of course, seeing things, maybe believing things, more likely just making things up, and it makes its way into papers. That's the sum total for many as far as the alleged 19th century airships go. But a couple of very interesting points on that have to do with, one, there actually were a lot of airships that were being built, and no less in California. Back in the late 1800s, I had an article that I did about this over at MicahHanks.com, which you can go over and you can read. I was actually surprised after I did the digging and did some research into that, just how many experimental airship projects actually were underway at that time. Now, the problem that we face with this, and one that has to be acknowledged, there, of course, is no evidence that the majority of those airship projects got off the ground. They were ideas, they were novel contraptions, but the inventors didn't ultimately succeed in getting those off the ground. Unless, of course, the sightings that were reported in 1896 and 1897 are actually indicative of some kind of a secret project. But then we're left with more questions, really, than answers. Because rather than being an answer to the airship mystery, oh, some people were building these things back then, they didn't get them off the ground, but then again, somebody saw something flying in 1896 and 1897. So, one of those projects must have succeeded, right? Well, now we are left to have to answer the question of if somebody succeeded, why was it kept secret? Why in the world would one of the greatest inventions of all history, at least at that time, why would that have been kept secret? In fact, one has to ask, how could that have been kept secret? But then there are the descriptions of those mystery airships, the landings where people alleged to have seen these things up close. They were quite remarkable machines, if indeed they were machines, if indeed these stories were true. Many of these aircraft were almost more like primitive kinds of planes, some of them more closely resembled blimps, but for the most part these things were far more like what you'd expect to read about in a Jules Verne novel. So what were these things? Where did these stories originate? Were these entirely imaginary? We'll have to see what Walter Bosley has to say about this, because he's looked into one of the most peculiar situations that might have had a relationship to all this, and one that actually predated the 1890s airship sightings by a few decades. But it's quite a story, one involving airships, a secret society, and all kinds of other interesting potentially historical parallels to modern aerial mysteries. We will be talking with Walter Bosley about that. Before we do, I want to take a moment to discuss a recent paper that I found to be very important that was published in The Scientist by Gregory Forth. It's an opinion piece, and in fact, a lot of you guys were sending this to me. It was titled, "Another Species of Hominin May Still Be Alive." Now, I've followed Gregory Forth's work for a number of years. He's published quite a few papers that make this argument, which might seem outlandish to many people. But here is essentially what he writes in his op-ed. He says, in 2004, the scientific world was shaken by the discovery of fossils from a tiny species of hominin on the Indonesian island of Flores. Labeled Homo floresiensis and dating to the late Pleistocene, the species was apparently a contemporary of early modern humans in this part of Southeast Asia. Yet in certain respects, the diminutive hominin resembled Australopithecines and even chimpanzees. As Forth writes, 20 years previously when I began ethnographic fieldwork on Flores, I heard tales of human-like creatures, some still reputedly alive, although very rarely seen. In the words of the Homo floresiensis discovery team's leader, the late Mike Morwood, last at the University of Wollongong in Australia, descriptions of these hominoids, quote, fitted floresiensis to a T, unquote. Now, stop and consider what he's talking about here, because he's saying people in modern times have seen something that they think is a good match for an animal recognized in the fossil record, and not just an animal, mind you. He's talking about an ancient human-like species that exists in the fossil record, which is known to have lived right there, and which people in modern times still claim to see, which is, to me, maybe one of the most, if not the most, potentially exciting discoveries that science, modern science, could afford us in the years ahead. Now, of course, reading this op-ed, one of the things that runs through my mind is I'd love to get Dr. Forth's opinion on things like alleged sightings of Sasquatch in North America, and then if we go to other parts of the world, of course, we have the Himalayan Yeti and the many stories that have been told about that creature for many years. In the Caucasian Mountains, there are the Almasti. There are even African traditions involving creatures like the Otung and the Agogwe. All of these essentially being various types of human-like bipedal apes, or, intriguingly, maybe we could say, ape-like bipedal hominoids. Call them what you will, there is a rich tradition all around the world of creatures that seem to resemble humans, but which we haven't managed to confirm the existence of. And because of this, most scientists therefore turn their nose up at this and they say, look, if indeed such creatures existed, we would know about it. But I often wonder, how sure can we be about that? How sure are we that there aren't other undiscovered species on our planet, and in fact, some that are far more like us than we would ever have expected? It's a fascinating prospect, and really, if you extend that idea onto other questions about history, how much of our past do we really fully understand? That is a question, of course, we're going to be getting into a bit with Walter Bosley this week, as we go in search of answers not only to his research into the 19th century airship mystery, but also how his own father might have had a relationship to the famous Roswell incident. We're going to look at all of that and more with Walter Bosley when we return here on the Micah Hanks Program. Could the modern UAP enigma actually have roots in the 19th century? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and where we are now headed, you guys had better find something to hold on to, strap yourselves in, because arrows, airships, secret societies, and of course, the ever-controversial Roswell incident all await. Indeed, I am very glad this week to be joined by a friend of the program and also a guest whose research probably goes in about as many different directions as mine has over the years. Walter Bosley is an independent researcher and an author. He's also a licensed private investigator in the state of California, and he joins me this week as my guest here on the Micah Hanks program. Walter, how are you?
Doing great, Micah. It's good to be back sitting here talking with you.
Yeah, I know. You and I had a great time together a few years back up in Canada, but, you know, occasionally we make appearances together on some of these shows. I think the last time I ran into you, you know, we had just lost Timothy Green Beckley, and you and I were participating in a chat on YouTube about that, and so it's a little more cheerful, our reason for getting together tonight, because it's to get back up to speed on what all you've been into. Like I mentioned, Walter, you know, you have a very interesting background that involves everything from intelligence work to private investigation and, of course, the unexplained. For anybody who's not familiar with your work, could you give them a bit of background?
Well, I'll tell you, after 20 years of essentially in the national security, intel, counter-intel community, I decided to start applying what I learned from that to looking into curious and interesting, weird stuff, you know, and it started with a book about the esoteric engineering of Disneyland, and that led to some follow-up research during which I stumbled into this thing that I call the Empire of the Wheel that resulted in three books that pulled the threads of some mysterious deaths a little over 100 years ago here in the San Bernardino Valley in California, and deaths which I suspected foul play was involved. And I very quickly discovered a lot of occult symbolism and clues and evidence surrounding this whole thing. And it grew into three books as I pulled more of those strange threads, which included things like the airship mystery and the curious art of Charles Del Shaw and his tale of the Sonora Aero Club. So you had strange technology. There's even the possibility that the mystery woman at the center of the first book may have been the historical Western figure Etta Place, the friend of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and just on and on. And in the middle of all that were, you know, what we call telluric currents or ley lines, you know, the energy of the world grid of the planet. It just was this expansive mystery. And that was followed by my looking into certain historical figures who appear to have had a hidden agenda in their exploits, specifically Juan Cabrillo, the first credited European explorer of what we know today as California, and Sir Richard Francis Burton, and Ambrose Bierce, the American author, who disappeared, curiously enough, in 1913, was never seen or heard from again.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Napoleon Bonaparte. Each one of these guys appear to have had a hidden agenda connected somehow or involving ancient lost civilizations and forgotten technologies and, you know, kind of occulted, arcane information. And that, of course, that's my Secret Missions book series. And you know, in between that, of course, as you know, I've written about breakaway civilizations, and I've written about Roswell and MK Ultra. And, you know, it just, it's all, here's what's interesting. It actually is all connected, because truly one book has led to the other. The threads left unpulled in a book, once pulled, led to the book that followed it. And, you know, that has been a never-ending source of amazement and curiosity, you know, on my part, because you wonder, okay, where is all this seemingly unconnected stuff leading to? And it's been an adventure, It's been an adventure. I wrote the Disneyland book in 2007, and it's been a nonstop adventure, you know, for several years.
Oh, it certainly has. Yeah. And of course, for those who have read your books, they have been along for that adventure. You and I have had some great conversations about that over the years. You know, I have fond memories of late night discussions in a living room, you know, expounding on some of these ideas. And it is interesting how one interest or one kind of idea that you might have and pursue will sometimes lead to other things that may not be directly related or seem to be at first, but then you come back around to that after you finish maybe one book and you're like, oh, you know, this was interesting. Let's look at this. And it takes you off down a different rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly. But then you ultimately, at least in my experience with what I've done, there are two threads, believe it or not, that connect all these diverse things I've looked into and written about, from Disneyland to the Empire of the Wheel thing, the airship mystery to all those explorers and Napoleon Bonaparte and on and Roswell and MK Ultra. And that is this, the presence one way or another of the lore and the symbolism of the ancient goddess Hecate, and also the presence and lore and symbols of the Celtic Tuatha De Danann, who are directly connected to and responsible for much of the fairy lore, which our friend Joshua Cutchin, of course, talks a lot about and has really explored. And through all the things I just described that I've written, those two threads run through all of it.
Yeah.
It's still a very curious thing that I'm still in the middle of trying to figure out.
Yeah, almost synchronistic. You know, going back to something that you said during the very beginning of your introduction, where you mentioned your background in intelligence. You know, a lot of people may know you best from having that involvement. And before I ask you a bit about that and also your family history, how your father fits into this equation as well, I wanted to ask you right here at the outset, do you have any general feelings about the current spate of incidents involving aerial phenomena being investigated by the Pentagon? You know, in other words, what the military has rebranded UAP. I would be very interested in getting your perspectives on that.
Well, you might. My opinion has been skeptical of all the excitement about this, and I think you understand this as much as anyone else who's been around this stuff for any number of years.
Sure.
You know, when you've looked at ufology, been around it for those several years, you see things as they come back up, you know, as they cycle in again, certain themes, certain ideas. And I think we're in a period where what we have right now, let's say in the community, the demographic, we have a bunch of folks who've been around it for a few years, okay, and are familiar with the history of how the government has looked at and expressed their interest or lack thereof, depending, in this topic in UFOs, and how the media has actually handled it and, you know, talked about it and such, what they've printed. And the people that are familiar with that, a lot of us, we're not seeing anything incredibly new here. We're not seeing this watershed moment. We're not seeing this revelation that, oh my gosh, the New York Times articles, the media has never spoken positively about UFOs. The government has never looked into them like this, which is quite honestly patently absurd. And it took me once I had this discussion back in 2018 with, you know, a younger person newer to this field, very enthusiastic about the recent developments. And it took me all of 11 or 12 minutes to find several newspaper articles from major sources, including the New York Times, dating back to the early 1960s and in through the 70s and I think into the 80s, in which the tone of the article was pretty much the same as the tone since November of 2017. Not mocking, not, you know, making fun of anything, not overly skeptical or anything. Those were just the ones that I found in a few minutes. And, you know, I presented this to the individual and, you know, they kind of didn't know what to say. They were like, oh, wow, I didn't know this. And I said, well, you know, that's exactly the point. If you go back and look at the history, the media has not always mocked this, and they have reported on it in a respectful tone over the decades. And then, of course, the government, we know, I mean, dating back to what project, you know, there's Blue Book, there's Sign, there's Grudge, there's, you know, you name it. The military, the DOD, really has always looked at UFOs since the beginning of the modern UFO era. So again, this talk and idea that, oh my gosh, this is something so new. I'll tell you right now, having been a person who worked and lived in that world of national security and intel, counterintel, and much of it with the DOD, I can tell you, my first thing was, I kind of smelled a perception management agenda. Hmm. And a lot of times people put a bad label on that. You have to understand, and this is where my military hat is on. You have to understand when you're talking about military technology and you're talking about dealing with adversaries that are rattling sabers, as ours have over the last decade, pretty obviously, you do have to play this perception game. And so perception management in that regard is not always some big evil men in black thing. In this modern world, it's often a very necessary thing. I have to wonder what particularly, specifically, the CIA agenda would be. Because, again, having a foot in both worlds, I was in their world, so I understand their motives and their objectives. And then I'm also in this world, the world that we're in. So I kind of go, come on, you guys. You know, I'm always in that proverbial, you know, spot between the rock and the hard place, right? Because I've had a view, I have perspectives from both sides. And so I'm probably, in all fairness, probably not the guy to ask in some respects, you know, but I'll tell you what, I'll say this. My jury, my inner jury is still out. I'm not sure what's going on. I'm not sure what the agenda is. I'm not sure, you know, how to take it. So I'm not sure what to conclude yet. We'll have to see.
Yeah. I like to keep an open mind myself, Mr. Bosley. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, at various times in your own career, I mean, I've kind of chuckled with you about this over the years. I know you for your esoteric research and for your historical pursuits, but you, of course, you know, famously, maybe some would say infamously, appeared in the documentary film Miragemen a few years ago, where, you know, some interpreted your participation as being, oh, he was one of them. Of course, I see you as being a very meaningful commentator who is providing some insight into that world. Do you ever feel that at times you've also been targeted as part of that, you know, that perception management effort that you're describing right there?
No, I've never thought about that, because I haven't been approached by any of the players. Now, that could be because they would say, oh, don't approach Walter Bosley because he used to be one of us, you know, and it's just don't go there, you know. You're right. As far as my participation in Mirage Men, that was my perspective, that they were asking me to just be, you know, someone commenting, having been in that world, someone commenting on that. And you're right. If the viewer pays close attention, you know, I had nothing to do with you know, the stuff that Richard Doty was involved in. In fact, I've never met the man. I've only had a brief text conversation with him over, I think Messenger. And, you know, so I was not directly involved in any of that. I was just asked to appear in that, just as you stated, as kind of a commentator. So yeah, it is kind of funny how some people go, oh, he was one of those guys in that movie. But most people actually, they totally get what, you know, what my role in appearing in that was. You know, to them it's clear. So I don't get as much backlash as I might have expected, honestly, to have been part of that. So, you know, it has been interesting.
Yes, indeed. It makes life interesting when you are the unwanted recipient of accusations that you are one of them. One of those mysterious G-men who's exploiting the UAP interest and just stirring the pot. Although I'm sure Walter Bosley is not one of those guys, we're going to continue this discussion about his research and the many threads that this follows when we return here in a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Continuing this conversation with our guest this week, researcher Walter Bosley. He is author of books that include the series titled Empire of the Wheel, but also a book that we're going to be discussing with him here that involves his very unique family history, which perhaps even has a little something to do with his own unique research interests. Specifically, I'm talking about your father, Walter, because my own father is a history fanatic. He is a guy who studies languages. And when I was a kid, I wanted all the books on UFOs. And for me, it was very formative, kind of watching my dad growing up and then seeing myself following kind of similar footsteps the older I get. Now, your father, of course, possibly was involved in some of history's most controversial events, which you've written about. Maybe that'd be a good place to kind of start, and then we'll see what your own inquiries into that may have yielded.
Yeah, my dad's story is it's definitely an interesting tale, as you know. That's why I ended up, you know, feeling compelled to finally look into it and write the book about it. But starting in 1974, he first told me about having been involved in a project in the Air Force in the late 50s. And because of this project, he said that he had been briefed in on the crash of, you know, back then in 74, you know, we called them all either UFOs or flying saucers, whatever you want to call it. And that there had been bodies recovered, and he had been briefed in on that. And over the years, you know, he would tell this story, and it stayed consistent. Even though, you know, I would draw more out of him, particularly when I got into my career and became an agent and was trained and experienced and became adept at, you know, doing the subtle interrogation techniques that you embed in an interview.
Sure.
And then, of course, as I was learning from sources that I worked with, more about my dad's situation. And it was just this fascinating story about this retrieval and about encountering these people who live in the subterranean areas of the planet. and you know, how this UFO that had crashed was not from another planet, according to my dad. It was from this civilization that lives inside the Earth that went down there thousands of years ago during a cataclysm and had developed their own separate civilization, wanted nothing to do with us, but they share this planet with us, and on and so forth. And over the years, you know, I would hear this story, it would stay consistent. My mentor, who had really got me started in that national security career, you know, he had told me he spent after Army Special Forces, he was in the intel community for 44 years by the time he retired. And he had told me, you know, in through the 90s that something indeed had, you know, happened with my dad out in the Southwest. And but he encouraged me to draw it out of him, and on and so forth. So a few years after he passed away, my dad, I decided, you know what, I really need to dig into this story. And what I found was there's my dad's story, which I will tell you, I am confident that he firmly believed this, but I wanted to approach this as honestly and sincerely, as objectively as I could, despite the fact that he was my father. So what I found ultimately was that during the time that my dad was in the U.S. Air Force, and specifically relative to the command he was in, which was the Aerospace Medicine Division, my dad was what you call a physiological training, physiological training unit specialist. They would run pilots through altitude chambers. They would teach them how to use their life support systems, meaning their oxygen masks and all that. And they would maintain them, and they would present materials and classes to pilots and air crew involving human physiology at high altitude, right? And my dad's unit at George Air Force Base was a unit that did the ground testing in altitude chambers, the ground testing for the Mercury program space suits. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is the Mercury program, which is dramatized wonderfully in The Right Stuff, the film and the TV series, that started as a United States Air Force manned space program before NASA even existed. It was turned over to NASA after October 1958, when NASA was stood up and began our very public civilian space travel pursuits. But it started as a U.S. Air Force program. And, you know, the capsule and the suits and stuff had been designed starting in the Air Force days. A lot of people don't realize that. That the U.S. Air Force and the Army Air Corps before it, of course, they were responsible for pursuing putting, you know, human beings into space, you know, for the United States. And this pursuit actually started as far back as the 1920s with Colonel Harry Armstrong, who was one of the guys who envisioned and made Operation Paperclip happened. A lot of people think Operation Paperclip was merely all about getting the bomb scientists or the rocket scientists. How it actually started was Harry Armstrong of the U.S. Army Air Corps. He really wanted to bring German aerospace medicine specialists, because these were the guys who were vital for putting human beings into space. Our whole thing about high altitude bombers and aircraft, that was all in the pursuit of going into space. And again, this dated back to the pre-World War II days, and of course in post-World War II, after Operation Paperclip happened and we got all these scientists. And one of the guys that worked with him was Colonel Otis Benson, who became a general, and he became the commander, and really the designer, but the commander of the Aerospace Medicine Division of the U.S. Air Force. And he was the commander of it when my dad was in. Oh. So Benson was very much a let's go to space kind of guy. This was all before NASA. And it also happened that the Aerospace Medicine Division, the psychiatry section, was brought in by the CIA on the early days of MK Ultra. And of all the military branches, the U.S. Air Force was the most excited by MK Ultra, so much so that they started their own MK Ultra research program. Here's what's interesting, a little side bit. In 1973, when the Congressional Church Committee brought the CIA before Congress and they had to fess up what they had been doing under this MK Ultra program, to this day, we don't know how far the Air Force took MK Ultra. So what does this have to do with my dad? Well, this they were doing this, messing with MK Ultra back in the 50s. And it was the very division my dad was assigned to. Okay, so I had to deal with that. It's like, oh, wow, what was MK Ultra really all about? Primarily, it was it involved planting false narratives in the human subconscious, the human psyche, to suppress actual operational memories. They were trying to create a hypnotically controlled assassin. That's what they were pursuing. And one of the things they wanted to do was to make sure that that individual, when they were not working as an assassin, didn't remember or you know, didn't know what they were doing when they were being hypnotically controlled. That involved laying a false narrative in the human subconscious. So here I had my dad having told me this wild story for decades. And what's interesting is elements of that story would have popped up in other people's narratives, okay? So I thought, okay, what's going on there? Then I learn the details and the truth about U.S. Air Force involvement in the late 50s with MKUltra, and I see that all that stuff with false narrative, and I begin to wonder, was my dad's story a false narrative laid into his subconscious through U.S. Air Force use of MKUltra? Because I had been told in the late 90s by my mentor that the Air Force had used a form of hypnosis treatment on my dad. And subsequent to that, as I learned more of the details about MKUltra, I realized I have to consider that the Air Force used MKUltra techniques and methods on my dad for whatever reason. He had something happen to him in the summer of 1958, the result of which was he was released off active duty early with an honorable discharge. And my thinking was, okay, this wild story he told, the false narrative laid over his subconscious so that he wouldn't remember what he was really doing. Then I had to think, so what might he have been doing actually that was considered so vital and sensitive that they had to lay this crazy story about UFO retrieval across his subconscious, right? So I dug into that, and during this same period, late 50s and through the 50s into the 60s, the DOD, of course, was getting involved with building somewhat extensive underground facilities. You know, the underground base type stuff. Right. And we know that's real, and they were really doing that because the patents are out there. I refer your listeners, of course, to the excellent research of Richard Sauter, who's written two or three books about, you know, on his research. Legitimate, here's the documentation, here's the patents, here's the actual facts. It's not fantasy tales. So why people say, well, why would they be doing this? Well, remember, this was the Cold War. This was the era of missile silos and missile bases and things like that, right?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. So the Air Force was very much involved with these underground facilities, obviously with their missile program. But my dad's specialty had nothing to do with missiles. So, you know, I thought, okay, there must have been some other project going on that had to have something to do with manned aircraft or spacecraft. Otherwise, my dad wouldn't have been involved because of his specialty. So my best conclusion, it's speculative, it's hypothetical, so far, my best conclusion is my dad was very much involved in some classified project that probably had something to do with the early days of, you know, putting personnel up in space. For whatever reason, there was an underground facility being utilized with this. Something happened, and they used MKUltra to lay a false narrative over his subconscious so that he wouldn't talk about what the actual project was. And that is my hypothesis for what happened with my dad, if his wild story is not true.
Right.
I do allow the reader to say, hey, you know, I say, hey, I could be wrong, but my point is, you know, you have to look at the historical context of these things, and you have to look at what's going on, and you have to be honest and objective. I mean, as a son, I would love to be able to say, my dad's wild story, he was briefed in about Roswell, he's had this encounter with a retrieval, he had this encounter with these underground people, and, you know, on and so forth. But I can't... I can't honestly do that when there's all this other historical context. And as a side note, to back up my point about how far the DOD, first the U.S. Army Air Corps, then subsequently the U.S. Air Force, had taken, you know, this pursuit of putting men in space, you know, starting right after the end of World War II, I lay out the evidence for my hypothesis that Roswell had nothing to do with extraterrestrials, that it was a first American attempt at putting humans in space. And I lay out all the details and why I propose this in that, in the same book, Shimmering Light, which I've written about my father's mystery. And it's just that book was, presenting a in some cases, you know, when you read the details, a brutally honest, you know, perspective on my dad's story and options for, you know, what could have been true. And therefore, you know, that includes a commentary on what is arguably the most famous, you know, event in modern UFO history. And it really, by the end of that book, It was eye-opening even for me, the things I learned in researching that book. And, you know, it helped me understand, you know, my dad and certain aspects of what he was going through in his life and such, you know,
yeah,
a lot better.
And I would say that there's probably a lot for anyone who would like a different perspective on the possibilities that the famous Roswell incident may actually afford us, what that may actually have involved. And I would say that those who think that they know the Roswell story very well should definitely check out Shimmering Light. It's no doubt going to give you a different perspective. All of Walter's research gives us a different perspective on the subjects that he covers, although I want to get his perspective on a very curious potential UAP incident when we come back here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Continuing a fine conversation this week with Walter Bosley. He's the author of books that include The Empire of the Wheel Trilogy, also Shimmering Light that we were just discussing, and there are others too, which we'll get around to here in a moment. First, I want to remind you guys, if you aren't already X subscribers, you're only getting half the conversation, and there's going to be plenty more with Walter this week. Head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. In the upper right-hand corner of the page, you'll see X memberships. Click that link. We also have that there in the show notes that you can access right there from your podcasting app. That'll get you where you've got to go as well. And of course, you will get additional weekly podcasts, monthly specials, well worth the $7 per month investment to get those X podcasts coming to your RSS feed on your podcatching app of preference. Now, with that out of the way, getting back into this conversation, Walter, something that really struck me as we were talking in the last segment, and you're talking about, you know, the possibility that what your dad said he remembered might not have been exactly how he remembered it. This really reminds me of another story that's worth mentioning here. Are you familiar with the strange case involving a man named Jerry Irwin, by chance?
Yes, I am. I talk about it in the book. And,
yep. Yeah, that's a really interesting one. And you may also have read David Boer's book, No Return, where, not having anything to do with Roswell, but again, this is a story about a guy who seemed to remember a UFO incident, but where later, of course, it's revealed he seems also to have been subjected to some, I think, for instance, there were memories introduced, and there were some attempts at using, truth serum to get him to talk about things. And as Boer proposed, as no doubt, you know, you exploring in your book, you probably have drawn similar conclusions. There seems to be a good idea, a good case to be made that there was something going on with Mr. Irwin that sounds an awful lot like MK Ultra type mind control or manipulation. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I included the Irwin story in my book Shimmering Light because I do offer the possibility that there was something, you know, of the extraordinary, okay, otherworldly, really happening with my dad's story. And I presented the Irwin episode as kind of evidence for that possibility. And about, was it like 6 months, maybe not even that long after I released my book, the Boer book came out on Irwin, and I realized, oh, he's been found. Because at the time I included the story, the story goes that Jerry Irwin disappeared and was never heard from again. And then the book comes out after I release my book, and this guy has found him and interviewed him and talked to him, and he's living somewhere in the Midwest, I think, or something. And so, but you touch on something exactly that I detected. I came away from the Boer book, that tells us where Irwin is and a little bit more about what actually happened. Yeah, I came away with the suspicion that what he had actually been involved in was some type of intelligence work, right? He had been recruited to be a potential intelligence asset. Some things weren't working out. And this was a period where, yeah, the military probably would have used some part of, you know, what they learned from MK Ultra on this guy. So even though it turns out, in my opinion, that the Irwin story doesn't turn out to be some fantastical ultra-terrestrial abduction story, it still, in my opinion, turns out almost equally fascinating, because clearly, in my opinion, he had been involved in that murky world of intelligence and the arcane methods and sciences that one can get exposed to. And yeah, I would agree. I think that's what really happened with Jerry Irwin and what's really going on with that story.
Yeah, that's just fascinating to me, because again, you know, one takeaway I have from, you know, your account of your dad's experiences and what might have been going on there was that, well, you know, apart from the interesting kind of parallel to the Shaver mystery and stuff like that, it's the insinuation that maybe some of the Roswell mythos that we know today actually stems from servicemen who perhaps were exposed to ideas, and that this was part of some sort of an intelligence operation. And maybe the Roswell case, or we should perhaps rephrase it as being the meme of a crash retrieval in the desert, there being bodies discovered and all of this, you know, that actually has origins other than an actual event that occurred in 1947. Although, you know, the newspaper reporting on there being a crash retrieval of a saucer and then, you know, the story being changed, that could have been the seed. That could have actually been the origin for what these servicemen were told, and that the actual mythos that was built around it, people who claim to have these memories like your father, it actually was representative of something more similar to what may have happened to Jerry Irwin. And I find that fascinating, especially in the context of the notion that there could be an earthly explanation for unidentified aerial phenomena, i.e. your UFOs. And this is really something that comes out of the story of the Empire of the Wheel, but not until the second installment. This is a great place, I think, to segue into that, because I've always enjoyed, Walter, your speculations about the idea that technological developments might have actually begun in the 19th century that could have relationships to not only the modern aerospace industry, but maybe also to UFOs. Take us back to the 19th century, where this begins in the Empire of the Wheel series, and how that eventually comes around to aerial mysteries.
Sure. And let me just briefly state that I should have added in there that what I think, for example, you brought this up. So what I specifically think, for example, the Tic Tac, the so-called Tic Tac, was that's our technology. That was an advanced technology being tested. There's been exaggerations. That's a whole other discussion, but that's my position on that. That's been my position on that from the beginning.
And just to be clear, why is it that you think that, Walter?
Well, the area in which the sighting happened is a well-known area where sensitive DOD, particularly naval research laboratory stuff, has been tested. Okay, and we're talking, you know, the secret stuff being developed, that whole area right off the coast of Southern California, where it happened, number one. Number two, people like to talk about this happening virtually right off the coast there, downtown San Diego. That's not true either. This region we're talking about and where the Tic Tac event happened, that was farther out at sea, and it was farther south. Technically, it was south of the U.S. Baja-Mexico border, okay? Out at sea, there's no people in cities, number one, that are going to see this. Number two, that are going to be endangered by anything, okay? Number three, they were on a very routine, what's called, you know, proficiency flying, you know, getting their hours in. And also doing their, you know, duty of the day, a routine sortie, you know, of just flying around a particular blah, blah, blah. And there were some exercises going on, that kind of thing, the kind of thing you do when you're in your home port. Those aircraft were not armed. People say, well, they would never test anything, you know, in front of our fighter pilots because, you know, the weapons. Well, they were not armed.
Right.
So they weren't going to shoot anything. Okay, that's like the third or fourth point there. Now, I've still had people say, well, there's no way they would test an unknown technology on our people. And I raise what we call the BS flag on that because you want an honest human reaction to some type of really exotic, what, you know, for its time is exotic technology. Okay. You are going to demonstrate its capabilities in front of unwitting people. Okay. You are going to see, well, how would a fighter pilot react to seeing this Tic Tac device, this amazing device, whatever it is? Well, why don't we just fly it around in front of a squadron of our Navy pilots that are out doing a routine unarmed sortie? Let's see how they react. And so you absolutely would do that. That kind of thing has been done in the past. And, you know, God bless our pilots because, you know, it takes a certain breed of human being, man or woman, to do that job. Okay. God bless them. But
sure.
I've been in the Air Force. I've known pilots and they're human beings. Okay. And when the Commander Fravor makes his comments like, you know, if it was ours, I would know about it. Oh, I'm, you know, all due respect, Commander, but wrong answer. That's a bunch of baloney, and you know better than to say something like that, because not every fighter pilot, not every squadron commander is going to be briefed on such exotic technologies in their development stages. It ain't going to happen. They do not brief those things down to, you know, certainly not down to the squadron level. So that was a bit of bravado, which I think helps the, oh, it was another world, you know, another world's technology narrative that's being pushed. So, you know, and all that goes into why I think what I think about the Tic Tac. And subsequent to that, you had those Navy patents come out, and one of them is virtually identical, you know, and our friend, who I know you're acquainted with, Michael Schrad, mm-hmm. he has historical evidence that the Tic Tac like device had been, you know, developed and seen decades before that. So there's many, many, many reasons to suspect that it's our technology, and virtually, well, few to not really any good reasons to think it's otherworldly.
Yeah, just to share briefly with you, by the way, what Michael Schratt's talking about, you know, the furthest back I've gone and found descriptions of Tic Tac like aircraft, uh-huh. you know, without establishing any kind of claims about their provenance, I'm just looking at UFO reports where people have seen these things, but they date back to the 1940s. There was one that was seen near Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The CIA documents that were released to researchers like Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett back in the 1970s and 80s also mm-hmm. turned up a case, but that case had been reported by NICAP back in the 60s, and they're the UFO evidence, and I'm talking about a sighting by some naval personnel at White Sands who were launching Skyhook balloons, but they saw essentially a Tic Tac way back in 1948, uh-huh. I think. So again, if you follow what Michael Schratt says, and says that, you know, whatever these things are, the technological development occurred and these things were being seen back then. Yeah, uh-huh. there certainly are earlier sightings. And one final point I'll just make too, Walter, is, you know, if you're really looking for an honest human response, you're not going to get that by telling pilots, oh, you know what, you guys are about to encounter the best that we've got, right. so let's see what you think when you see it. No, you're going to send them out there and say, we got a mysterious trace out there west of Baja. I'm going to vector you guys out there. Let's see what happens. And you sit back and you gauge their response, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Now, all this said about it looks like the Tic Tac itself, whatever it's actually called, was, you know, something that was ours being developed. All this said, there has been reason for, you know, we're going into our third century. There is some reason to suspect that technological development, as you mentioned earlier, has been a little bit more exotic than traditional history teaches.
Yes.
And so that leads to the possibility that there could be other players out there developing, you know, advanced technologies that's not ours. It's very human, terrestrial, you know. And where does this idea come from? Well, it really comes from popularly. For instance, the story of the Nazi bell, Da Glocke.
Oh, yes. In fact, that name rings a bell. Sorry, Walter, I couldn't help myself. And hold that thought right there, because when we come back, I'm going to have Walter tell you all about what he is talking about and how this idea may relate to the mysterious history behind terrestrial phenomena attributed to UAP. We'll get into that with Walter here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Walter Bosley is my guest. We are discussing his various research pursuits. But where we left off right before the break, he had touched on really what is kind of a cornerstone as far as the modern idea that some of the UAP phenomena and the technologies behind it could have origins during the Second World War. You were just talking about Da Glocke there, Walter. Would you like to pick up right there?
Well, for the longest time, people thought clearly if the Nazis developed something like Da Glocke, the bell, they had to have gotten it from some otherworldly folks. And they point to this lore and this really what is a myth of a Nazi E.T. saucer retrieval, which didn't really happen, never really happened. When you look at the bell, you see very much earthly technology, exotic, the results of it, and the things they allegedly were doing with it, but still Earth-based. And if you look at other sources in history, you can see similar concepts to what Nazi Germany was allegedly doing with this Bell device. And some of those basic concepts, and I'll describe the basics of the Bell and how it worked, some of those concepts can be suggested by ancient transcripts. Okay, so what are we talking about with the Bell? The Bell was this device, this strange device with two cylinders, one cylinder fit inside the other, and they would spin and they would specifically counter rotate. One went clockwise, the other one went counterclockwise, right? And in between was injected this this serum, for lack of a better word, that has been popularly called red mercury or something, but it was actually, when you look closer, at some type of mercury solution, okay? And allegedly, this device, when operating, resulted in levitation of the device, or anti-gravity. And this is where people get the idea that the Germans of the World War II era then developed flying saucers with this technology and from this, which, by the way, the whole Honnebu thing is a post-World War II myth as well.
Right.
But still, you have this Bell story, which is out there, which utilizes very earthly technology, carried out, of course, to an extraordinary level by the 20th century capabilities, meaning the injection of powerful electricity technology, right? Electric technology. Now, the other problem with the idea that Nazi Germany got this from aliens and extraterrestrials happens to be the gentleman who I think you mentioned, named Charles Delschau. And in a nutshell, Charles Delschau was this interesting fellow who lived in Texas, was a butcher, and he was a German immigrant. He died in 1923, but between 1893 and 1923, when he died, he created just dozens of these amazing picture books. The books depicted these objects, which he called arrows, A-E-R-O, mm-hmm. Okay? And these arrows were, according to Delschau, flying machines that were being designed, engineered, and built and flown by this mysterious group of German immigrants in California in the 1850s, the decade before our Civil War, and over a half a decade before the Wright brothers. Okay? And to top it off, what Delschau described went into these devices and how they worked was that they appeared to have been some type of anti-gravity device, for lack of a better way to describe it. And Delschau's drawings, there were just many of these things. Some of them were, you know, one guy could ride in it. Others were, you know, several crew people. And he described the propulsion system, and even drew out multiple times the diagram of how the propulsion and lift system worked. Well, what's interesting about that is 40 years after this Sonora Aero Club was active in Northern California, we had the great airship mystery of the 1890s. And what's yeah. interesting is about that is that the basic technology running those things included the stuff that Delschau said that the Sonora Aero Club was doing 40 years prior. And there was even a connection with the personnel, because witnesses claim to have met two gentlemen named Wilson. They were related. One, I think, was an uncle, and, you know, the other, the nephew. And there was a gentleman named Wilson in the Sonora Aero Club decades before. So what does this suggest to us? It suggests that this mysterious group, the Sonora Aero Club, somehow what they had developed and they had done had made its way across the decades and was expanded by people subsequent to them to possibly explain the 1890s airship mystery. And, you know, and then, of course, those disappeared. And, you know, we know the history of aviation after that. But it was left with, well, gosh, if this group of German immigrants in California in the 1850s was messing with this, you know, kind of technology, where did they get the idea? Wow, did they get it from, you know, ancient texts like in the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, you know, the ancient Hindu Vimanas that we hear about? Because the Vimanas, when you look at descriptions you can find of those, it's very much like the bell, bringing it back to the Nazi bell, where you had the device that's literally shaped like a bell, and it used this, what modern engineers have called the Mercury vortex engine. So there's your Mercury. And, you know, you had to wonder, okay, did this Sonora Aero Club get their information from ancient text? Well, I thought that was probably the case, handed down through secret societies or little engineering groups, you know, experimenting with things. I thought that was the likely answer until, Micah, last year when I dug into this more, and I found the story, the information about the Rankine turbine. Now, what is the Rankine turbine? Yeah. Well, the Rankine turbine was designed by a guy named McCorn Rankine, who was one of the two founders of the field of thermodynamics. This was in the early 19th century, or early to mid 19th century. And Rankine, in 1851, published his diagram for what's called the Rankine turbine cycle. And it is virtually, I did a little video on my Walter Bosley channel at YouTube last summer. Uh-huh. It is virtually, Micah, identical to the drawings of the engine process system that Charles Delshall's drawings depict.
Hmm.
And this was published in 1851, and Delshall says the Sonora Aero Club operated in the 1850s. I have come to strongly suspect, confidently, that whatever the Sonora Aero Club was doing, they were applying the Rankine turbine. That's R-A-N-K-I-N-E, the Rankine turbine, invented in, I think it was invented in 1849, published in 1851. They were applying the Rankine turbine to whatever their particular fuel mixture was to get their flight result. And it really astonished me when I stumbled over this, because what did that do? That further emphasized that what the Sonora Aero Club, according to Delshall, was doing has a root in very earthbound technologies, okay?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then it goes to further emphasize that also the 1890s airship mystery can be explained by one of these private, you know, very secretive groups developing this technology further. And you have to wonder, once we got into the 20th century, you know, where they went with this. And I argue one of the places they went was the Nazi bell. Why do I think that? Well, remember I said that Charles Delshall was a German immigrant,
mm-hmm.
and the Aero Club was a group of German immigrants in the 1850s. Charles Delshall, in his own story, his diaries, and remember, he died in 1923, years before World War II started. He says that he was working for this group based in Berlin called the NIMSA, this interesting group,
yes,
you know, German organization called NIMSA. And they were the organization that that the Sonora Aero Club and apparently other groups like them were operating under their aegis, okay, their direction, their guidance. And Delshall claimed to have been hired by NIMSA and sent to the United States and on to California to observe and report back to NIMSA on the progress of the Sonora Aero Club. So why is that important? Well, you got all this German thread right here. You have this mysterious group NIMSA. You have the German immigrants in Sonora, California, according to Delshall. You have Delshall himself. So you have these Germans fooling around with this particular technology. that involves spin and rotation and some type of, you know, fluid dynamics kind of thing and, you know, turbine, blah, 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 so forth. Okay. And as I lay out in a couple of my books, you can follow this German thread through the 19th century and see how what Delschau was describing, what this mysterious NIMSA group was fooling with and the Sonora Aero Club was developing, it's very similar to the proof of concept, rudimentary, basic level of what Nazi Germany was allegedly doing with the Bell. So therefore, you can, and I do argue this, that the Nazi Germany, the scientists got their ideas and concepts and the development of the Bell, which they took farther, they got that from a German line of development dating back, you know, about 100 years prior to World War II. They didn't get it from retrieving a flying saucer from another world. They got it from, you know, these German scientists that had been dabbling and with this stuff and developing it. And with, you know, my kind of discovery or stumbling upon of this Rankine turbine, you know, I'm even more confident that what we saw with the Nazi Bell and maybe even with most of the UFO mystery through the 20th century, what we're seeing there, in my opinion, is some type of breakaway group, as we like to say now, who has been privately pursuing and developing exotic technologies for a long time. And it doesn't completely eliminate the ET element. I still think ETs account for, you know, a small percentage of legitimate UFO sightings. Of course, I think that's only logical. You know, I have no problem with technologically advanced intelligent civilizations from, you know, other planets. I have no problem with that idea. I think I'm just going to, you know, eventually learn that, well, of course, you know, but I think that the overwhelming majority of UFO sightings and such can be explained by either our own known technology being developed for military purposes, or these private groups, such as Delschau talks about, such as apparently, allegedly, were demonstrating what they had in the 1890s airship mystery, and on and so forth. And when you look at the threads, the potential threads of the NIMSA and the description by Delschau of this mysterious group NIMSA, it really leads to the industrialists and you know, scientific types, the guys that were pursuing this kind of stuff in the German military industrial thread, so to speak, leading to their military industrial complex and such. It's a fascinating story. May not be as exotic as someone from another world, but I think it's equally fascinating because there's this whole world of science and technology that is being kept from us.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating, too. And, of course, our guest is Walter Bosley, an all-around fascinating guy. And when we come back, Walter, I want to get your thoughts on a document that has origins from within a three-letter agency. This may actually have some relationship to some of what you're discussing. Walter and I will continue this conversation on the other side of this break. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Wrapping up this conversation with Walter Bosley, at least as far as the public show goes. Keep in mind, X subscribers, we will always have additional commentary, and that will certainly be the case with Walter Bosley this week. He always has a lot to say about a variety of subjects, as is already evidenced by this conversation. But Walter, before we go any further, I want to share a little something with you, a bit of an anecdote on this line of thought here that you're following. There was a memo that was dated November 7th, 1957. This was released in a batch of UFO files that were obtained via the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI. And researchers Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett published this in their book, Clear Intent. I want to quote from a portion of this, which has to do with a man from Warsaw, Poland, who was brought from Poland as a prisoner of war to Gut Al Golsen, which is about 30 miles east of Berlin. In May 1942, he was serving there, and he remained there until the end of the Second World War. But according to a testimony that he provided that was in this document that was actually sent by no less than Robert Cutler in the memo in question, here's the account that he gives. He had been a part of an operation, and he said that there was an SS guard that appeared and talked briefly with a German driver of a tractor who waited 5 to 10 minutes, after which this noise that they had heard, okay, off in the distance, kind of stops in this swampy area. According to the memo, he says, approximately 3 hours later in the same swamp area but away from the road where the work crew was cutting hay, he surreptitiously, because of the German in charge of the crew and the SS guards in the otherwise deserted area, observed a circular enclosure approximately 100 to 150 yards in diameter, protected from viewers by a tarpaulin-type wall approximately 50 feet high, from which a vehicle was observed to slowly rise vertically to a height sufficient to clear the wall and then to move slowly horizontally a short distance out of his view, which was obstructed by nearby trees. This vehicle, observed from approximately 500 feet, was described as circular in shape, 75 to 100 yards in diameter, and about 14 feet high, consisting of dark gray stationary top and bottom sections, 5 to 6 feet high. The approximate 3-foot middle section appeared to be a rapidly moving component producing a continuous blur, similar to an airplane propeller, but extending the circumference of the vehicle so far as could be observed. He describes a noise that was being produced by this object and noted, interestingly, that the tractor nearby, that the engine stalled when this object appeared to rise above this enclosure and they were testing this vehicle. Now, it's anybody's guess whether that is a true story or not. It, if anything, seems to kind of feed into some of the myths and conspiracy theories involving Nazi UFOs. But in light of what you're describing about what Delshaw recorded in his journals, the insinuations about this mysterious NIMSA organization, which I want to get back to here in a moment, and other points that you've made, it does make you wonder about the possibility, if nothing else, of secret developments that were actually begun well in advance of the Second World War, but perhaps some of those innovations continued throughout. Now, of course, I guess another one of the questions that comes to mind here, and many other historians have looked at this as well, if these technologies were being developed by the Nazis, why didn't we see these come to fruition? Why weren't they used in battle, or were they? And if so, you know, how, who obtained that technology after the fact, and has it continued to be developed up until the present day?
All of these things were proof of concept, essentially rudimentary. Like what the Sonora Aero Club was doing, if you look at what Delshow draws, the schematics he offers, and you read his descriptions, you'll realize that these were very much in development. They were very much early proof of concept models, okay? And if the airship mystery really happened the way it reported, and I think it did, that really was the first time that these proof of concept ideas were expanded upon to any impressive degree, and yet they were still not so developed that that there wasn't yet a lot of work to be done to make them more reliable and ready for industrialized production, that kind of thing. And you got to remember too that at the same time, the standard combustion, you know, engine, piston engine, you know, the stuff we're familiar with was being developed to a degree that was much more conducive to mass production. Remember, this stuff wasn't going on in a vacuum. It was going on during, you know, in the advancing years of the Industrial Revolution, to where what was it becoming? It was becoming all about mass production. What can I mass produce that will work, you know, every every example of it will work and the average person can use it and it's reliable essentially and blah, 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 so forth. So really, it's simply that reason that, for instance, airplanes got supremacy in the air, because that kind of technology that the, you know, Wright brothers developed from stuff that was going on in France and Italy for, you know, a decade before that. The known technology that we have seen, the stuff that was used during the war, this was the stuff that could be mass produced more cheaply, right? And went beyond proof of concept very quickly. So that was the more economically feasible for, you know, industrialists, you know, these guys, they need to make money to be able to do the things they do, and they want to make money. So for whatever detailed reasons beyond those basics, this is why the known technology is known to us, because it was easy to mass produce. It made people more money now, you know, faster than these more exotic things. And I would argue that in the story of the bell, we have finally a beyond proof of concept, modern technological extrapolation of this very thing we're talking about, that you know, that the Sonora Aero Club was messing with, the Rankin turbine, and in the bell we finally have that emerging. So when people say, well, where was it? Well, there it is right there. Yeah, it wasn't feasible during World War I. It wasn't even feasible, you know, leading up to World War II. And it was being developed during World War II. I'm convinced that the Kexburg UFO was out. I think we captured either a working bell, or, you know, we definitely captured the scientists who were the ones who made it happen. And I think the Kexburg UFO was a result of our post-war continuation of whatever the bell was.
Also a very interesting perspective. And unfortunately, the clock is catching us here for the Maine Public Podcast. Ex-subscribers, as always, there will be a little more with our guest, Walter Bosley. But before we wrap up here on the Maine show, Walter, would you tell folks where they can find you online, follow your work, and of course, find your books?
Sure. My books are never, I like to clarify this, they are never at Amazon. I don't sell on Amazon. They're not good for small press publishers, which is what I am. My books are print on demand from lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, and they're worth the wait. They're affordable. They're quality printed books, just like you get anywhere else, but that's the only place you'll get them. I'm also at the Walter Bosley channel at YouTube. I do a live stream every Sunday afternoon, California time afternoon. And in between that, I do all sorts of little pre-recorded reports, and I read from interesting books, you know, little chapters here and there. And I do other fun stuff, like I'm a kit model builder. So I do little videos occasionally on if I'm building an interesting model kit, or if people send me boxes, I do unboxings. But, you know, so I have my research, and I have a little bit of fun over there, too. The Walter Bosley channel at YouTube. And you can find me, you know, if you want to contact me directly, you can find me at Facebook and Instagram, you know. So that's where I'm at. And I look forward to, you know, anyone who wants to check out the YouTube channel and join in on the live chat room when I'm live, you're welcome. We welcome you to our little community.
Indeed. Well, it's always fun to catch up and talk with you, Walter. I always enjoy it, and you always offer very stimulating thoughts and always a different perspective on things that are widely discussed. So keep up the good research, and I certainly look forward to talking with you, maybe actually seeing you in person again sometime soon, a little sooner on down the road than later.
Yeah, we'll make that happen. We gotta do that. It's been a couple of years since we've all been able to, you know, do things face to face, and yeah. You know, over the last several months, more and more things are happening. So, you know, we gotta cross paths here soon.
I hope so. Well, again, thank you, Walter Bosley, for joining me, and we will catch up again soon, my friend.
Thank you, Micah.
Indeed, and of course, I will make available for all of you listeners out there all of Walter's links where you can follow his work online right there in the show notes. You can check out his books and also keep up with his various research efforts. Also, check out that YouTube channel he was talking about. If you'd like to follow my work, you can just head over to MicahHanks.com. You can also follow me at MicahHanks on Twitter. info@MicahHanks.com is the email. All of that information and much more available there at the website, MicahHanks.com. That about wraps it up for this week, guys. Thanks, as always, for being along the ride as we continue our pursuit of the enigmatic. And as always, have a great week and stay strange out there.